Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing doubts about why Donald Trump is meeting with Putin in Helsinki and what is the nature of their relationship. Malcolm Nance, a career U.S. intelligence officer and author of The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West, joins us to discuss the extraordinary disconnect between the latest indictments by Robert Mueller of 12 Russian military intelligence GRU officers and the Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats' warning that the red light is blinking, as it was before 9/11, warning that, quote, today the digital infrastructure that serves this country is literally under attack by Russia, and our president's eagerness to get along with Putin, who orchestrated the meddling in our 2016 elections and is now orchestrating Russia's ongoing cyber attacks on our infrastructure and election systems. When asked by CBS News what is the biggest foe America faces globally, the first thing out of Trump's mouth was the European Union, not Russia. And we will examine the evidence which suggests Trump is either Putin's useful idiot or a traitor who has bought into Russia's agenda, which, if true, would make Putin Trump's case officer and the spymaster behind the most significant intelligence operation since the Germans sent Lenin in a boxcar to Russia in 1917. Then we'll go to London to speak with Polly Toynbee, a columnist with The Guardian and the author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. She joins us to examine the trail of wreckage in Donald Trump's wake as he trashed NATO, undermined the women leading Germany and the UK by, in effect, campaigning on behalf of their political opposition, then advised Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May to sue the EU rather than negotiate with them over Brexit. We will also assess the impact of massive demonstrations in London and Scotland and the indignation felt by many in response to Trump posing smugly in Winston Churchill's armchair. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the radical break from traditional U.S. foreign policy and diplomacy, with the president intent on destroying treaties, alliances, democratic institutions, and diplomatic norms, and speak with Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We'll discuss how discredited ideas and policies and blunders like Iraq ironically contributed to Trump's election, which has led to a dramatic worsening of these trends. And joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the U.S. government special operations, homeland security, and intelligence agencies, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin, Cyber Spies, and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And his latest book is The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Malcolm. And I'm absolutely dismayed at this disconnect between you've got Robert Mueller indicting 12 GRU Russian military intelligence officers for hacking the DNC, the DCCC, and Hillary Clinton. You've got the DNI, Dan Coats, a Republican senator, warning that the digital infrastructure that serves this country is literally under attack. And he's compared the situation today as the blinking red lights of the warning signs that the U.S. faced ahead of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And yet you've got Trump eager to meet with Putin at a meeting which he's never explained what it's about. I mean, apart from that, we're just going to try and get along. I mean, it's bizarre, is it not?
It is absolutely bizarre. And as you say, the juxtaposition between two things. One, his national intelligence apparatus, his director of CIA, his national security agency, his FBI, and everyone else telling you that we are not prepared for what is going to come to us. The only person who's been the outlier is the director of Homeland Security, and we've already learned that she will say whatever the president tells her to say, to the detriment of the nation. But Donald Trump himself absolutely pretends as if nothing has happened. And now he's going to go meet the actual villain who ordered this attack on American democracy and act as if he is an ally. In fact, he said he's not our enemy. He could be our friend. We'll see. We've already seen the insane level of obsequiousness that he shows to Trump. And it just goes to show we are in danger.
Well, CBS News' Jeff Glore at Trump's golf club in Scotland asked him, you know, who's America's greatest enemy? And right out of his mouth, the first thing was the EU. I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
That is absolutely unbelievable. But, you know, as I just wrote my latest bestseller, which is number 6 on the New York Times bestsellers list, The Plot to Destroy Democracy. And in it, I outline the entire Russian strategy and now Trump strategy for the dismantlement of democracy around the world. And a core component of that is their absolute animosity to the European Union. And Donald Trump seems ready and willing to assist in the destruction of Europe as it has existed since the end of World War II. And that benefits only Russia.
So when Adam Schiff, the minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, which is for all intents and purposes defunct because the chair is clearly operating in conjunction with the White House,
right.
Adam Schiff said today that Putin is going to eat Trump's lunch just as Kim Jong-un did. And when asked about the – by the way, Trump said that he hadn't thought about it when Jeff Glore asked him about, well, is he going to ask Putin to hand over the 12 GRU officers? But when Schiff was asked about what the meeting would be about and would Trump ask the important questions about meddling in our elections, Schiff pointed out that Trump shouldn't have to ask that question. And the fact that he's been forced into asking that question and has said that he will sort of do it, but in a rather reluctant and dismissive way, again, adds to this suspicion about what is going on here.
Right. And his reluctance, it's less than a reluctance. It's an annoyance that he absolutely has to say anything at all and that he is only being forced to say these things because he expects a pro forma response and that the news media is goading him into it. This is literally almost suspicious to the point where you wonder whether he is actively betraying his oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. No president of the United States would debase the nation by saying that, yes, an attack on the United States is some trifle that he needs to ask his buddy about. It's just mind-boggling, absolutely stunning. And again, this points to that danger that we, as a representative democracy, as a constitutional republic, may in fact be in a situation where we're undermined by the man who has sworn, who was elected, and not by the majority, by the way, who was elected by a fraction of a minority in the Electoral College. Despite his protestations and grand pronouncements. But he, you know, the Constitution always was designed to put in check a person who was elected who was a tyrant or a dictator or a king or of the mindset of one of those three. But what we have now is we also have a Congress that has decided that they will act as a Politburo and put a rubber stamp on anything that this would be autocrat decides.
And again, I'm speaking with Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the U.S. government Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And his latest book is The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. Now, if this ends up being just like the Kim Jong-un situation where it was a basic and extended photo opportunity, and then immediately when Kim got exactly what he wanted, and now he's basically giving Trump the back of his hand. In Putin's case, my sense is that they will work together. This will be orchestrated to give the impression that Russia is no longer our enemy, which is Trump and Putin's way of basically saying we don't need NATO anymore. Do you think that's what's going on?
I think there's a lot more to it than that, and I think you're absolutely right on that point. So let me take it one step at a time. The Russians have had a strategic plan for certainly the last 15 years about how they want to re-engineer the world. And what's interesting is all of the players on the Russian side are ex-communist. Now, granted, communism collapsed in 1989. They all became rich capitalists. Vladimir Putin may have as much as $200 billion of illicit funds from the liquidating of the Soviet Union back when he was the enforcer of the mayor of St. Petersburg and then the prime minister of Russia and then president of Russia. But their natural inclination as a nation, they are conservative Christians. And over the last 10 years, they have been currying the image in the West that they are the heart of Christian conservatism. And American conservatives have flocked there, both evangelicals and American politicians. Russia views the United States and has always viewed the United States as an obstacle to their greatness. So the Russian strategic goal in this particular instance is that they have to bring us down to a certain extent. And the best way to do that is to use a military strategy that they've developed over the last decade, where they have co-opted a large part of the American population's opinion by using social media and weaponized free speech that was developed. All of these techniques were developed in the Soviet Union's era to discredit democracy as a governing philosophy. But now it could only be executed by an autocrat strongman like Vladimir Putin, former director, KGB officer, former director of Russian intelligence, but with the same goal: discredit democracy, put into power an American ally who is also an equal autocrat, and then dismantle the Western order nation by nation to create an axis of autocracies. It sounds a little ludicrous, but if you look at Europe, most serious European conservative parties are all funded by Moscow, all of them. They have already taken over the government of Hungary with Viktor Orban and the Jobbik Party. It's extremely far-right conservative party. The government of Poland, they are less under the influence of Moscow, but they have the exact same operating philosophy as Trump. Hard-right extremism, hard-right Catholicism. The government of Austria is 100% owned by Moscow. They were funded through Moscow for the election of the Austrian Freedom Party, which was joined with the Austrian People's Party. The Austrian Freedom Party was formed by Nazis in 1952 and is now the ruling body of Austria. And they immediately joined in partnership with United Russia, Putin's party, as soon as they were elected, and then came to Trump Tower to bend at the knee of Donald Trump. The government of Italy is now a hard-right extremist government that started talking about rounding up the gypsies, the Roma, off their streets and deporting them. This is really going badly in Europe, and the only thing that saved Western democracy, as far as I'm concerned, was the common sense of the French people last year in rejecting Marine Le Pen. And her job, after accepting 50 million euros from Vladimir Putin, was to to take France out of the European Union on day one, which would have broken up the European market, and to remove France permanently from NATO, which would have started the dissolution of NATO. This would have created a new alignment of the world away from the Washington, D.C. to European capitals alliance since the end of World War II, and to a Russian-centric poles of right-wing conservatism that would go Moscow, Washington, Europe, and would completely change the way that we live. Global markets would collapse and be broken up, and the dregs would be sold off to the oligarchy. Now, as silly as that sounds, it is in action right now, even as we speak, and you can see Donald Trump relishes being part of that plan.
Well, as silly as it sounds, it is also Stephen Bannon's philosophy and his ideology. Yes. And he's working with those right-wing Italians as we speak and the other, and they are all bound by this notion of white Christian Europeans under attack from foreign influences like Islam and, as you mentioned, the gypsies. So when did Trump buy into this? Because I recently spoke to the former head of the European desk at the National Security Council, and he concluded that indeed Trump has bought into that ideology, which Putin has. And of course, gays are also thrown into the mix in terms of being Untermenschen, as the Nazis referred to them.
Right. Well, you know, Donald Trump was going to decided that he was going to run for president on November 6, 2012. In fact, there's a very little known Facebook post that was made by the head of Russia's Channel One, the guy by the name of Konstantin Rykov. He's known as Putin's Ted Turner, right? He's Putin's propaganda, one of his propagandists, because he runs Russia television for the most part. And he had tweeted 2 days after the election of Trump, the entire four-year plan. And apparently, Rykov said that on the night Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama, Donald Trump put out a tweet saying, we should march on Washington. This shouldn't happen. I should run for president. Rykov sent a message to him and said, if you intend to run for president, we in Russia will help you, a direct message. Trump sent back to him a photograph of him on his executive jet, giving the thumbs up. 1 year later, Trump is establishing the Miss Universe pageant. The Russian Internet Research Agency is now in operation. Cambridge Analytica gets its first contract to do data analytics on the U.S. election. But the most noteworthy and what I call a critical intelligence indicator of how Russia co-opted Donald Trump's mindset and created a framework for him to exist in, for him to actually, you know, understand where, you know, he belongs to a certain extent, and to influence his decision-making process, is when he went to Miss Universe and he had a private 2-hour off-the-records, nobody taking notes, meeting with the 12 richest oligarchs of Russia, including a personal representative of Vladimir Putin. And for 2 hours, Donald Trump was read the Riot Act on what Russia's positions were on Crimea, what Russia's position was on the European Union, on NATO, on American defense establishment, and the alliance of how the world should be laid out. Interestingly enough, within 3 months, tweets turned to those exact talking points that Vladimir Putin would use. When Crimea was invaded in February, March of 2014, Donald Trump immediately tweeted that Vladimir Putin is a strong president and was completely neutral about Crimea, other than the note that Crimea spoke Russian. It is utterly amazing that for 2 years, the U.S. media could not figure out where Donald Trump's anti-NATO rhetoric started, where Trump's anti-European Union rhetoric started. If you look at the Kremlin talking points for the last 4 years, they are word for word the same, which means that, for example, last week or 2 weeks ago, Trump was asked about Crimea. And, you know, Trump tends to talk off the top of his head. And what he says is what he learns. And the first thing he said about Crimea when asked about would he confront Putin about Crimea was that, well, you know, Crimeans all speak Russian. Essentially, the exact talking point of Vladimir Putin after the invasion, justifying the ethnic annexation of Crimea. It's just utterly amazing. The Nobu restaurant meeting with the 12 oligarchs of Russia is where Trump was not infected, but where he was convinced that Russia is his base, and that so long as he doesn't, so long as he goes along with the base, understands their position, advocates for their position, the great realignment of the world can happen, and it will benefit him and his family. All evidence points to this being true, including the indictments we saw yesterday the indictments against the Internet Research Agency, and this will consume this administration. People will go to prison, and Donald Trump won't survive this as president of the United States. I often say this man is going to give the name Benedict Arnold a run for its money.
And, of course, later that evening after that Nobu meeting with the oligarchs, there was supposed to something supposed to have happened in the presidential suite of the Ritz Hotel. But also it's worth noting that when Donald Trump returned from Russia, he immediately began this canard that the president, Barack Obama, was a Kenyan and started the Bertha movement, which right. in a sense gave right-wing Americans permission to be racist again. And that formed the constituency that is his base to this very day. So it seems like a coincidence. But just in the last few minutes, let's talk about the indictment that came down on Friday from Robert Mueller, announced by the embattled Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. We know that Roger Stone was an interlocutor with Guccifer. He's admitted as much, and I think he's in deep trouble. Right. But also Lee Stranahan of Breitbart News now with the Russians Sputnik. He was also mentioned, and a Florida GOP operative, Aaron Nevins, was mentioned, along with somebody that they didn't name in the indictment, a congressional candidate. So who do you think, because, you know, that's the missing part of the indictment, isn't it? We know what the GRU was up to, but we don't know who their American interlocutors were.
Right. Well, you know, when I wrote 2 years ago, which came out 5 months before or 5 weeks before the election, my previous book, Plot to Hack America, I spelled out that all of the lines of inquiry that we identified yesterday, that were identified in the indictment yesterday, because, of course, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm an intelligence officer. And in our world, we have the ability to recreate things because there are things which must be there, right? And for the last 2 years, I've said that the GRU were the handlers for WikiLeaks, the FSB, and the Internet Research Agency, of which there's more than one. There's more than one Internet Research Agency. Would have been the people who created what we call propaganda products, but that there would be multiple dirty tricks teams under the Trump administration. And I think everyone that contacted Guccifer 2.0, who I identified very, very early on, I think I identified on the day that he started that this was a GRU operation. Because, as you know, I was writing another book called Hacking ISIS, and we identified the GRU as pretending to be ISIS in two incidents. And so as soon as I heard about the Democratic Party hacking, it became clear that this is Watergate 2.0, which is the name of that first chapter in my book. And the only people that would do this could be the Russians. And then when it came out that it was Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, you know, cyber malware suites that were carrying this out, clearly Guccifer 2.0 was the GRU. There's just no way about it. But the Americans linked to Guccifer, I think you're going to find that there are a minimum of 5 or 6 independent dirty tricks team. Roger Stone, Lee Stranahan, Nevins. I think it will go as far as implicating in the next round of indictments, absolutely, WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is a Russian intelligence laundromat, but it will also include Cambridge Analytica and all their senior staff, the Trump data team and all of their staff who were involved in handling these products. Those are where you get the mainstream. And then we're going to have Michael Flynn, because Michael Flynn was a coordinator for many of these. Donald Trump Jr., because he appears to have been taken a hand in coordinating at least one particular component of this. All of that being said, you're going to find round number 3 is going to be what I call the tier 3 Americans, which are the lower level Americans who were in direct contact with the Russians. Papadopoulos will come tell his story. Flynn will have a chance to tell his story. Manafort's trial will be on, which will be intense because they will be burning this guy with everything he ever wrote and said for the Russians. And then when that round is done, I think that by the end of the year, we're going to be at the tier 2 people, Jared Kushner, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, or all the subordinates to Donald Trump. Everything will point to that Donald Trump knew every one of these dirty tricks teams was an operation that the Russians were working for us and with us, and he didn't care when it all cost. And that will be, and again, this nation will go into a crisis the likes that we've never seen, because this is the single most important investigation in the history of the United States.
Well, Malcolm Nance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
So it's my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Malcolm Nance, who's a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the United States government Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And his latest book is The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back assessing and go to the UK to assess the impact of massive demonstrations against Donald Trump and the indignation felt by many in response to Trump posing smugly in Winston Churchill's armchair.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
London calling to the faraway town. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys. Beatlemania is putting the dust. London calling. See, we ain't got no swing except for the rain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the UK is Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. She is the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is May's Brexit Plan is Here, and it's a dead duck already. Welcome to Background Briefing, Polly Toynbee.
Hello.
So I'd like to talk to you, obviously, about the trail of wreckage Donald Trump has left in his wake in this last week, after having trashed NATO and undermined the women leading Germany and the UK by, in effect, campaigning for their opposition. But I'd like to begin with the front page of the Daily Mirror with a huge caption, "How dare you?" And they go on to say, "You insult our country, attack our NHS, embarrass our queen, undermine our special relationship, humiliate our PM, and then smugly pose in Winston Churchill's armchair. Hardly our finest hour in terms of diplomacy."
I think not. I know that number 10 Downing Street, that Theresa May's people were extremely full of trepidation about what this visit would be. Its timing was really unfortunate in terms of the very, very delicate stage. Well, it's nearly always delicate. Her Brexit negotiations are tiptoeing along, and she had finally produced, after 2 years, a plan which has not gone down very well with her very split party, has not gone down well anywhere, and is unlikely to go down very well in Europe either. But it was kind of the best she could do when she is confronted with such a deeply divided nation over the whole question of Brexit. Nothing could have been more unhelpful than to have Donald Trump arrive, blow it all apart, tell her she's doing it all wrong, stir up his friends, and including praising Boris Johnson, our recent foreign secretary, who had just resigned from her government over this plan, and saying he would make a very good prime minister. I mean, you can't be more outrageous than that, really, in terms of undiplomatic behavior. So he really has left a trail of chaos behind him. I mean, the far right of this country, of course, like Donald Trump very much, And when he says, announces loudly, people like me, I know people like me in Great Britain, the polls show about 77% of people are strongly against him, but that means that there are still some people who are on his side.
Well, 250,000 people showed up in Trafalgar Square on a work day, did they not?
Indeed. There have been demonstrations all over the country, the ones in London biggest, but also in Scotland, where he's been at his golf course, and in small towns all over the country, sort of places that would never have demonstrations normally, have been scattered with demonstrations up and down the land. I think people feel passionately that he is, you know, an unfitting visitor to us. It's not quite a state visit, but it's still nearly a state visit, and that we are humiliating ourselves by begging for a trade deal with him, on our knees to him, because we have put ourselves in this disastrous Brexit situation. And just as he has been trying to blow apart Europe, has been telling the French president that he should leave Europe as well, he wants the European Union destroyed, under whether this is under Putin's instruction, we don't know, but we have our suspicions, blowing apart NATO disastrously. It's left us in a very humiliating position. We are very vulnerable. We've made ourselves vulnerable with this insane decision to leave the European Union just when we most need to be holding together strongly and depending on one another in Europe, as we look across at America and say these are no longer our allies, or at least the current regime no longer feels like our oldest, best allies.
And, of course, in an interview with CBS's anchor at his golf course in Scotland, Trump was asked, what is the biggest foe America faces globally? And the first thing out of Trump's mouth was the European Union. That is surreal.
It is incomprehensible. I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. And there are reasons to think that perhaps it's not as straightforward as that, but you know, anyone looking at this objectively would say that everything that he has done is to Putin's playbook. It's everything Putin would wish him to do, with the exception, of course, of Iran and his breaking of the Iran agreement and making extra trouble in Iran. That's the surprising element that might make a conspiracy theorist say, no, it's much more erratic and peculiar. But today, this weekend, there has been published a 10-month-long investigation of Trump's Russian commercial connections done by our Financial Times, which is our most reputable newspaper that would only publish, you know, pages and pages and pages of this stuff, having done the most thorough financial investigation. And it's based on the Trump Toronto project, which went bust, but in which it looks as if huge amounts of Russian money came through, closely connected to Russian government contacts. It's a very complicated story, as these things always are, and the ordinary reader is not likely to read in detail. But on the other hand, I think this may provide quite useful evidence to what you were just talking about now, current investigations in the States.
And again, I'm speaking with Polly Toynbee, who joins us from the UK. She's a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and features writer for The Observer. And she's the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is May's Brexit Plan is Here, and It's a Dead Duck Already. Prime Minister May, in the wake after Trump's wrecking ball, she said that Trump advised her to sue the EU rather than negotiate with them over Brexit. What does the polling tell us? I would have thought that the British people will be having buyer's remorse because this Brexit thing was so stupid and it's been so impossible to implement that the smartest thing would be just to sort of forget about it and maybe have another referendum. And I'm assuming that the public would vote to, forget the whole sorry story.
It's very difficult to tell. There's not a lot of buyer's remorse. it's rather like in the United States that we are such a divided country. It is the older people who, as a generation, or on the whole anyway, less well-educated than the younger generation, who are most strongly for Brexit. They are the nostalgists who look back at Britain's great days. It's a kind of make Britain great again. We can manage out there on our own in the world. We will reconnect with Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, with the exception of the United States, you know, kind of white commonwealth ideas. And, of course, India, China. These are fantasies. There's no reason why we shouldn't have plenty of good trade deals with all those people. The European Union itself has trade deals with 60 countries, which are deals that we will lose the moment we leave. But these are people who are not interested in detail. It's rather like Trump supporters. It's a deep emotional identity feeling about who Britain is, who we want to be. And no amount of facts and figures seems to shift those people very much. But it is changing in that there is now a 5% in favour of remaining, partly because the Grim Reaper knocks some of the older people off and new young people come onto the electoral rolls, partly because I think moderate people in the middle who just went for Brexit have suddenly looked over the precipice and maybe have understood, if they read good newspapers, quite what peril we are in and quite what would happen, and also how increasingly erratic and unreasonable the pro-Brexit lobby has become. They now say, we'd be much better off to have no deal at all. Don't let's have a deal, then let's just walk away. But if we did that, as from next March, on the 29th of March, we leave Europe with no deal, with no transition arrangement, no nothing, the barrier comes down immediately. The trucks, thousands of trucks that cross every day across from Dover to Calais and other places around the country, stop being able to move. Every single truck has to be checked on the other side. It would lead to a blockage going halfway up the country, up the motorway system, of lorries in queues waiting to cross the channel. It would mean no flying agreement, the basic flying aviation agreement, so that we can land our aircraft in the European Union and they here. Without, you know, these are basic deals that countries have between each other without having to be in a union. We would lose all of that overnight. But they are so fanatical, these people, that they just dismiss it and say, oh, well, we'll sort it out. But these are very real threats to us. And I'm afraid there are still a lot of people in the country who don't really get it as to quite how catastrophic you think. Oh, no, it's called Project Fear. You're just trying to scare us.
Well, presumably these people are mostly vote Tory, and the Conservatives are in disarray. Is there a possibility that that government will fall? And if so, would Corbyn win? And he was pretty waffly and kind of weak on Brexit to begin with. But the assumption would be perhaps that he would call for another referendum. What do you assume he would do?
He's not really in a position to call for anything. I mean, Labour will not, nor will any of the opposition parties, not the Scottish Nationalists or any of the rest, none of them will vote for any plan that she brings forward. Even if she comes back from Europe with a final deal that is, you know, quite a soft one, none of them will vote for it. They will all say, this is still going to be self-harming and worse than staying in. That leads to a complete impasse where she can't get through Parliament agreements because she doesn't have a majority. She can't get through agreement for the deal. But nor can she get through agreement to have no deal, a total impasse. At that point, it is just possible, it's not most likely, but it's just possible that the only thing she and Parliament can do is to say, well, throw this back to the voters. Let them decide, do they want to accept this deal of hers or not? It's a risky strategy because in this country, 85% of the media, the newspapers, who are very powerful despite the decline in newspapers, are of the far right and are of very passionate Brexit supporting. 40% of the newspapers belong to Rupert Murdoch. who has been a prime agent over the last 30 years in trying to get us out of Europe and having his papers endlessly sent, putting out ludicrous stories about the abominations of Europe, if Europe were our enemy and not our friends. So they would again have a very strong position in any future referendum. They put out quite disgraceful lies throughout the entire referendum. The Daily Mail, which is one of the worst, not a Murdoch paper, but as bad as, had front pages for the entire month run up to the last referendum of shock horror stories about immigrants arriving here. Pictures of threatening-looking, dark-skinned men arriving off the back of lorries who say, these are illegal immigrants we can't send back. The numbers of criminals in this country who are immigrants. If we, unless we leave Europe, potentially 80 million Turks will join Europe, and then they'll be allowed to come here any time they want. I mean, they were really disgraceful, racist threats day after day on the front pages of a lot of this press. And my fear is that they will do that again, and although immigration has gone right down as a public concern in the last couple of years, they would manage to stir it up again. In any country, you could stir up fear of foreigners. And I think that might happen again. So it would be very knife-edge how a future referendum would go, despite the fact that we are confronting the reality of what Brexit really means.
Well, just in the last minute, though, I can't see how the UK can have it both ways with Brexit. On the one hand, you can't have the benefits of the EU without following the rules.
Well, we helped make the rules, and Margaret Thatcher herself was the creator of the single market, which was a very important idea of a level playing field where you all obeyed the same rules, you all obeyed the same state aid rules, there was fair competition between all companies in the entire European Union. We were inventors of these rules, and now we're saying the rules are being imposed upon us. But of course you can't really cherry pick them. I don't see how, even though I'm sure that European countries don't want us to leave, I don't see how they can bend them sufficiently, particularly on the question of free movement of people across borders, to satisfy the fanatics within the Conservative Party. I mean, as for another general election, I think that's pretty much impossible because we have a new law which David Cameron passed, which makes it very difficult to call a general election. It just happens every 5 years. And you need two-thirds of the House of Commons to vote for a general election to get one. That would mean the Conservative Party would have to vote a vote of no confidence in itself, which is inconceivable, particularly when they look at Jeremy Corbyn and think they don't want him to win.
Well,
so
Polly,
I think we will stagger on.
carry on.
carrying on, and things will get worse.
Right. Well,
I
thank you so much for joining us, Polly Toynbee.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Polly Toynbee, who's a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and Associate Editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. She's the author, co-author of Dismembered, How the Attacks on the State Harm Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is May's Brexit Plan is Here, and it's a dead duck already. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the radical break from traditional U.S. foreign policy and diplomacy, with the president intent on destroying treaties, alliances, democratic institutions, and diplomatic norms. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Walt, the Robert N. Rene Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and he writes frequently for Foreign Policy, and his forthcoming book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And obviously, it seems paradoxical to me that Donald Trump is a builder, yet he tears things down. And he's left a wreckage in his wake in this last week, having trashed NATO and then tried to undermine the two women running Germany and the UK by, in effect, campaigning for their opposition. And then he's off to meet with Putin at the same time that his own national security establishment, the so-called deep state, along with the Republican director of national intelligence, are all warning that Russia is attacking us attacking our frail infrastructure. So let's start with that paradox. Is Mueller and Coates, are they sending a signal to Trump and the Republicans that something real is happening here, while what is likely to happen in Helsinki tomorrow doesn't appear to be real, at least grounded in reality?
Well, there's a lot going on there. I think it's quite clear Trump has always been at odds with what you might call the foreign policy establishment, certainly with respect to institutions like NATO and the European Union, the sort of general set of liberal alliances the United States has had, and also his attitude towards Russia is quite different from that of the establishment. So in that sense, they are, I think, sending a very different message than the one Trump has sent. With respect to his behavior in the recent NATO summit and dealing with Merkel and Theresa May during his visit to the UK, there's a bit of a gap between Trump's behavior and what actual U.S. policy has been. At the end of the day, the United States remains committed to NATO, the Defense Department, the Republican Party, the rest of the foreign policy organizations in the U.S. are still very strongly committed to those institutions. Trump, as an individual, and going back really to his original campaign in 2016, has always been rather, at best, skeptical towards them and, at worst, actively hostile. So what we saw over the past week was basically a lot of personal misconduct, sort of insulting, berating foreign leaders, criticizing May in an interview and then making nice otherwise. At an individual level, in other words, being sort of a bull in a china shop, even though the actual substance of U.S. policy hadn't changed very much. The only thing to worry about there, of course, is that, the president's conduct does matter. Words do make a difference over time. And I think most European leaders do understand now that his commitment to a lot of these relationships is paper thin, and that he is at least as interested in dividing and weakening these institutions as he is in strengthening them. That is all somewhat separate from what's likely to happen or not happen in Helsinki.
Right, but what you just said appears also to be Putin's agenda. And if these two have a love fest like Trump and Kim Jong-un did in Singapore, they might well come out with some kind of glossy but rather thin communique saying that we are no longer enemies, and that would be a first step in saying we don't need NATO anymore.
Well, I think that's the thing that has most people worried. I believe that the meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore is not a bad predictor of what we're likely to see out of Helsinki. When you think about it, Trump is a former reality TV show host. He likes a big audience. He's very good at coming up with dramatic events where there's lots of spectacle, where all the news organizations, shows like yours, etc., will worry, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? He's got everybody's attention. And then what happens, of course, is not much, because he doesn't care about details. He's not really interested in the substance. He just likes a lot of people watching. So I think we're not going to get a lot of substantive accomplishments one way or the other out of Helsinki, but we may get either a vague agreement or signals that the United States is not that upset about things Russia may or may not have been doing. He's not going to challenge Putin on any of the areas where we disagree. And again, that does, as you suggest, send a bit of a signal to others that maybe you can't quite count on the United States as much as you used to.
Well, my understanding is that the reason Putin is doing what he's doing is that after he annexed Crimea and started a war with Ukraine and shot down the Malaysian airliner, etc., and the international community ostracized him and brought about these severe sanctions, that he turned to the only thing he has in his playbook, which is hybrid warfare, which he's used very successfully. And my assumption would be that if the sanctions prompted Putin to take that strategy of asymmetrical warfare, then getting rid of the sanctions, which Trump, I think, wants to do, would then basically do the opposite, would it not? In other words, that would be the deal. I'll stop screwing with you guys if you relieve the sanctions.
That's at least one possibility, but that would require Trump to acknowledge that the Russians had, in fact, been engaging in hybrid warfare directed at the United States. And, of course, he's been unwilling to ever admit that that was really what was going on, partly because I think he has always believed that if you acknowledge Russian interference, then maybe you have to acknowledge it had an effect on the election. And once that happens, then that undercuts his legitimacy as president. He didn't win fair and square, as you will. And Trump, for various reasons, has not wanted to go there. Moreover, of course, it's not clear that would be a particularly good deal from an American or a Western perspective anyway, because hybrid warfare is something you could turn on again. So in a sense, Russia would end up pocketing Crimea, could make a promise, we're never going to do this again, and then a few years later resume it. And the place where Trump is, I think, on firmer ground is to suggest that it's not a mistake to talk to Russia. There's nothing wrong with him talking to Putin, that we have various issues that we would like to work out with Russia. It is an important country. It is the world's second most powerful nuclear-armed power. And therefore, trying to put them in a box and not having any dealings with them is a mistake. So the idea of him talking to Putin is not a bad one. The problem is you would like this to have been done in a more systematic and careful way. You'd like Trump to have been listening to the Russia experts in his own administration and within the U.S. government. You'd like to have prepared a real agenda for this, and you'd like to have some other people in the room with him so that you had some idea what he was talking about and whether or not he was making reasonable arrangements or not. And, of course, none of those things appear to be true as we run up to this meeting.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University and the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he writes frequently for Foreign Policy, and his forthcoming book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Your book will be out, I think, in a month or two. But let's just, if we could, just at least talk about the thesis in the book in the context of what we're talking about with Trump, how discredited ideas and policies and blunders like Iraq ironically contributed to Trump's election, which has led to a dramatic worsening of these trends.
Well, the basic argument here, and I think what we're seeing now with Trump's handling of foreign policy is that from the end of the Cold War forward, you know, through the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration, the United States was pursuing a very ambitious approach to foreign policy where we were going to sort of manage almost all problems in the world and spread American values as far as we possibly could, sometimes through peaceful means, but other times through military force, as with the invasion of Iraq. And none of those things worked out very well. And that between that and also the mishandling of the U.S. economy and the financial crisis, this discredited the sort of governing elites in the United States in a variety of ways and opened the door for an outsider like Trump, who not only did not have a political pedigree of his own, but could run a campaign that was dismissive of a lot of orthodoxies, and especially of the ones in foreign policy. NATO's a bad deal. An open trading order is, robbing Americans of jobs. We shouldn't be doing nation building in places like Iraq or Afghanistan, etc. He really did run for office challenging almost all of these orthodoxies, and as a result, he was actively opposed, not just by Democrats, but by many, many senior former Republican officials. And then since he's become president, he has challenged. He's not completely, but in many ways, tried to implement the agenda he promised in the campaign. I think he's faced a lot of resistance within the Washington establishment, and some of his ideas, I think, have been completely wrong-headed and won't lead to anything good. But in a sense, we got Trump in part because the establishment had misbehaved, had not held itself accountable, and ultimately lost an enormous amount of credibility, so that when they criticize Trump now, people do not find their criticisms as persuasive as perhaps they should.
And does that explain the craven nature of the Republican lawmakers in both the House and Senate? What a paradox. The party that used to be the red baiters and the Soviet haters are now enablers or apologists for Trump and Putin.
Well, I think it's more striking in some other areas, in particular, the Republicans' willingness to go along with Trump on his trade agenda. It is interesting that, for example, that the Congress has passed resolutions defending the American commitment to NATO, and they've done so almost unanimously. So one of the places where Republicans in the Senate and in the House have been much less willing to follow Trump's sort of wrecking ball approach to these various institutions. On many other issues, I think the deference that he has received from the Republican Party is palpable and quite surprising, given where that party used to be not so very long ago.
Well, Stephen Walter, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Nice talking with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Walters, a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he writes frequently for Foreign Policy, and his forthcoming book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.